Is that going?
Yeah.
All right, I won't touch it then.
I haven't heard from Lois since we went online. She must be over the moon.
I don't know. Okay, let's start with prayer. Lord, thank you so much for this nice day and your Shabbat you've given us. Thank you for each person who's made it here this morning, everyone on their way. We pray you bless our discussions, bless your words as we read them. Help us glean what's good for us to know. Even sometimes it's hard to find something that applies directly, but we trust you that your word is good, and when we chew on it, we get something from it for our long-term health. And we thank you for it. In Jesus' name, amen.
Amen. Amen. It's certainly true today. I mean, there's so much that...
There is a lot in our little parasha today. If you checked online, what happened is last week we skipped forward, so now we've gone back. And so we will be looking at Genesis 26, verse 12 to 35, which is the rest of Isaac's story. And then the prophetic passage that is connected to Genesis 26 is Isaiah 62, 8 through 63, 7. Welcome, everyone. So, as I said, we're backtracking slightly. We looked, not last week, the week before, we looked at Isaac and Rebecca, the third sister story. She's my sister. And it happened in Gerar, in the land of the Philistines. And so where we're starting today is at the very end of that story. And I will mention, because it's appropriate to jog our memories, at the beginning of chapter 26, we'll remind ourselves that there is a famine in the land, besides the first famine that was in the days of Abraham. Right? So there's a famine in the land, and we know the story that Isaac decides to go to Gerar. Where is Gerar? Anyone know?
I assume it was on the way to Egypt or sort of Gaza way.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we all know where the land of the Philistines is, right? It's down south on the coast. I have a very small map here. I'll draw it here really quick. Let's say this is the Great Sea, otherwise known in English as
Mediterranean.
So, let's see, we have to get another sea in here. You know, I think today this isn't even water anymore, but let's say that's the Dead Sea. Jordan River goes up there. And let's say Jerusalem is here. Okay, you follow the ridge route down and you get to Hebron. Oh, sorry, I'm learning English. And then you follow that down north and you get to Beersheba. And then you go over to the sea. Have
Is Gerar the name of an area or a town?
Gerar, well, it's a city in the Bible, but let's say Pleshet. It's generally the Philistine territory.
Right.
And there's a Nahal here, and then we're going to have maybe the Chobot, right?
really is the spine of Israel.
Exactly. You start to see the ridge route. Abraham's journeys follow the ridge route, and they kind of end up south. He started in the north, and he wandered down south. So Yitzhak goes to Gerar, and as we pointed out 2 weeks ago, as soon as he gets to Gerar, God appears to him, and he says, "Don't go down to Egypt. Dwell in the land that I will tell you." And that reminds me of in chapter 22, remember when God appeared to Abraham and said, "Go to the mountain that I will tell you," right? So it's kind of a little bit vague, but we know that it's the promised land has been promised before, so we can fill in the blanks a bit. And he says after that, "Live or dwell in this land, and I will be with you and I will bless you, because for you and your descendants I will give it these lands, and I will keep my oath that I swore to Abraham your father." I'm reading from the beginning of the chapter, chapter 26. And it repeats the blessing that he had given to Abraham. And so he does. Yitzhak is living there, but he's again afraid because his wife is so beautiful, and so you have that whole thing again. And that's where we pick up in verse 12. So when nothing actually happens when Avimelech takes Rebekah this time, but he accuses Isaac and says, "Why did you say she was your sister?" And so Isaac replies, "I didn't want to die because of her." And Avimelech says, "What have you done to us? Someone could have slept with her and we would have been guilty." So he has a very high sense of morality. He's not just going to steal the wife and do what he wants. And because of that, this is verse 11, Avimelech commands all his people, "The one who touches this man or his wife will be put to death." Okay, so he's got some type of protection. And then the very next thing, Isaac sows in the land. Okay, that's very interesting, right? Because it's a famine. It's a drought. Well, I'm taking it one step further. When you have famine in this land, it's because there's a drought. There are no plants. So you could say, you know, he's sowing in faith. I don't know. And he finds in that year 100-fold. In that land, in that year, 100-fold. So that's an interesting little addition. Why do they repeat in that land? We already know he's in Gerar, right? In that year. Why is it significant for us?
Well, first of all, there's a drought, so the mere fact that it's 100-fold is completely over the top.
Okay, definitely. Well, even without a drought,
exactly.
100-fold is completely over the top.
Right.
But now it's saying not only that, but in that year of a drought,
right,
in that place, what kind of land is this down here? Anyone been down here outside Beel Sheva?
Heading to desert.
What does it strike you as?
Sorry.
Barren? Is desert the Negev?
Sandy.
It is not a place I would choose to plant a field, right?
We did it in Gush Katif.
If you have modern drip systems, maybe. But especially in a famine year, it's, you know, camels survive well there, but I wouldn't choose it to put a crop. So it's really what you would call barren land. And to be reminded of that, let's see if we can quickly...
We don't... There's famine in the land.
Mm-hmm.
Do we know from the beginning that the famine is as far south as this?
It's got wells. There's actually a water pond.
Well, this is my point, though. Yeah. Whether there's famine or not, Beersheba and its environs do not have much water. So it's still not ideal for planting much of anything. Well, yeah, but he didn't say exactly when. Okay, we're going to get there too, but I just want to remind us, see, where is it?
So they don't even know if anybody was planting there.
Well, I assume they had to live somehow, but I don't know if they're doing a lot of trading with people.
And it's not just his crops which produce 100-fold. The man becomes rich and his wealth continued to grow until he became very wealthy.
Right.
He had so many flocks and herds and servants that the Philistines envied him. So these animals are eating something.
Right. Well, normally, I was reading a bit about that, if you planted fields, by the way, this is a place that we know that Isaac did more than just raise cattle. He also cultivated.
Right.
Up till now, the fathers have been very nomadic.
Right.
But here we see that they are planting fields.
Is it the first time we actually get a story about planting?
From Abraham's family? I think so, yeah.
I think so, yeah.
I mean, we've been reading through it up till now, and this is the first point that we have them sowing seed. Hey, welcome. And so, anyway, so your cattle, oftentimes, after you harvest, you would let the cattle eat the leftover grass and hay in your fields. And you use the cows to plow the fields again. So, as I said, it's hard rummaging out there. There's not much vegetation anyway. But, I mean, there is something. You can drive down to Beersheba today and you'll see, you know, flocks of goats and sheep. I think it would be harder for the bigger cattle, the cows. Because those, even in biblical days, are associated with Bashan.
Yeah.
Because cows like to herd in forest areas.
They eat much more.
They eat much more.
Whereas goats can gravel over the spring.
That's
spring
right.
Green,
goats
all over
can
the
eat
hills,
almost
like
anything.
Here now.
Cows have got long tongues and they need long flocks to curl around in fully.
There you go.
They're not into grazing.
Cows have long tongues and they need a big enough plant to yank it out. Goats can just like nibble way down to nothing. They can get their nose in there. So cows are more suited for forest and groves, places with trees. Like the Bashan is a very good place for cows. Goats can do better in the area of Beersheba. But here, of course, he has cows and goats, and they keep multiplying.
He's staying in one place.
Yes.
I mean, because
if you plant a field,
the sheep and goats destroy the vegetation.
Right.
Pull it all up. So you keep moving.
That's true in general, but you can rotate, you can move in rotations. If you plant a field, there's no point planting it if you're not going to stay there long enough to harvest.
What she was saying is that the initial nomadic way was basically eat what's there and move on and go and hope that you find a hill, whatever, to keep your animals going better. So there's no story until now of him settling down, even though he's settling down in Philistine land.
Yeah, it's a very interesting thing why he chooses now to plant a field. But maybe he's kind of taking God at his word, saying, okay, you're going to bless me here. Do something with this.
When I was reading it, I looked up all of the parables about what it is to
sow
and produce.
And we'll get there. Hold on a second.
Okay.
But it says in verse 3, God tells him, live here, and
yeah.
I will be with you and bless you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So he thought, well, he says, live here? Well, I guess I better stay put.
Absolutely.
Yeah. No. Okay. But in the past, when God has given promises, we don't hear, and Abram went out and sowed a field.
Yeah, definitely.
So, so that's a new step. But I'll remind us, if you look quickly at Judges 1, verse 14, we have Caleb's daughter. Do you remember her? Achsa?
No.
She asked for work.
She asks her father for a field, and she jumps down from the hamol, from the donkey, and Kalev says, you know, what's wrong?
What verse is it?
Verse 14.
What chapter?
The first chapter of the book of Judges, verse 14. And she says, give me a blessing, because the land of the Negev you've given me.
Give me also springs of water. So the implication is Negev is dry.
Negev is dry.
So I need the water as well. So you gave her the upper and lower springs.
She's saying, look, you gave me his inheritance, this dried out piece of land I can't do anything with. Give me a blessing. That means give me something like water, something where I can do something with it. So we know that Negev, even for those who haven't been there, they can know from this text that it's not the greatest land to work with. It's not like this prized possession. And it's very hard to bring wealth of food, vegetation, and even flock, for that matter, because they're all dependent on the vegetation. So to point out, it was in that year, the year of the drought, and in that land, the land of the Negev, this is like pouring water on the altar that Elijah did. And God blessed him. So not only do we have an over-the-top, one seed produces 100, we have, even in the year of drought, even in the Negev, it's like you can't get any more miraculous than that. We are looking at an extreme miracle. And the next verse indicates Isaac as a man is getting bigger. And usually to mention this, it's talking about status as well. That's maybe a direct result of the wealth. He's getting bigger and bigger, until he was very big. And there are parallels there with Moses. And who else does that remind us of? Yeah, okay. And Jacob hasn't gotten there yet. I guess you're remembering in the future.
Oh, you're looking back. Who does it remind us of?
Oh, well, no, I guess in the Bible in general. It mentions not only once that he's getting bigger and bigger, but several times. He's getting bigger and bigger and bigger. So that's also kind of an exaggeration, in the same way that the Mea She'arim is an exaggeration. Which, by the way, you've all heard the word Mea She'arim before?
Yeah.
She'arim is it's a homonym. Sha'ar is a gate, She'arim are gates. But this She'arim is different. It's a
measure.
So 100 measures, or 100 fold. So the term Mea She'arim has nothing to do with gates. It is 100 fold measure. And again, what we would see as miraculous, actually. Okay, so I was looking for... All right, never mind. I was looking for some verses, but we get the point. So he's got little cattle, he's got big cattle, and he's got avuda rabba. So the question is, what is this avuda? It's a workforce. So servants, I guess a more of an abstract way of referring to male slaves, female slaves. Some people interpret it, if it were just avuda, it would have been field work or land work in general, but this includes vineyards and all kinds of stuff. I don't know. But an interesting little word.
So what is interesting, I mean, we haven't even got through it yet, but the whole passage is about this miraculous, what you call over the topness.
Yeah.
And we even, now we, here we are in the middle of the desert, and we have, I think, 7 different wells. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. No, maybe it's only 6. Whatever. Six or seven wells. 7 wells. They're always saying we found water. We, I mean, okay, they start to argue about them, shut them up, and all the rest of it. But to find 7 wells and end up with Beersheba right at the end,
it's true.
Just totally over the top.
It's all over the top because we're, again, we're in a drought, we're in the most dry country, and it's here we have this miraculous harvest. And we might as well mention now, Gemma brought up the parables in the New Testament that correlate to this. Do you remember the parable of the talents?
I was thinking of the sower in Matthew 13.
Wait, am I confusing it? Is this sower?
It's this
about the Me'asharim.
Me'asharim? Yeah. Okay, so, but not Matthew, isn't it Luke?
It's both.
Luke
that
8.
Is the Me'asharim.
I mean, Matthew has 116.
Yeah. So, Mark then, I haven't looked at it that recently, but Mark and Matthew basically have 3 measurements, and one starts with the least and goes to the most, one starts with the most, goes to the least, or something like
that. Yeah, but what struck me was that...
But the Me'asharim there definitely refers back to...
The hundredfold, and what it's talking about, the soil, and, you know, the seed is planted, and if it's lousy ground or whatever, but if it's good ground, you end up with a hundredfold.
Yeah.
What is it that stops the hundredfold? And I've never seen it before until this morning. It's... In some versions, it talks about the cares of the world, but in the NIV, it talks about worries, pleasures, and something else. I can't remember what it is. 3 different things. And they're
cares
such normal things.
Yeah, no, very normal
they're
things.
They're very normal things. It's not sort of, oh, I've done committed some fearful sin, and that's what's wrong.
No,
with
it's just being distracted with life,
and
know,
it's
fixing your pipes.
And having the concerns instead of what ultimately happens is God says, don't do it.
Mm.
And like Abraham, like you say, Abraham says, right, okay, in spite of all these crazy situations, I'll go and do it. I'll go and live there.
Right.
And I'll dig my wells and I'll plant my crop.
And again, there's that element of faith, because if good soil, you know, I think 100-fold is always a kind of a miraculous thing.
Right.
But to happen in bad soil is more miraculous.
But you could say that our hearts are pretty lousy soil. That's
yeah, you could say our hearts are lousy soil. Or at least there's good mixed with bad, right? And we all need water, which is what the Negev needs. And of course, the provision of water in the desert is often seen as a divine thing for the children of Israel wandering in the desert, even for Samson. Remember his victory? He kills 1,000 people, and then what happens? He almost dies of thirst because he can't find water. And it's God's little reminder of, you know, you think you're so strong, but you can die in an instant without water. Like where water is often a metaphor for our dependency on God, both physical and spiritual. We need his water. And especially, that's why this is the promised land, because it does not have natural, sustainable water. It's so dependent on rain. And it's not Egypt where they have a river all the time and they just have to bring it in to water their plants. It's not like you have huge Euphrates or huge rivers. You know, the Jordan River, it's a joke, right? It's not much of a river. You have to go way up north to even see water. Like, what? You know, and that flows into the Dead Sea.
Sometimes. Well, it's worse today.
It's worse today because we pump it out in different directions. But still, it was never this...
It was never the Mississippi.
Exactly. So this land, by nature, can be a nice metaphor of needing to have faith in God because you simply must for your survival. And so here we have a provision. If you look at the words, he finds... Okay, he's getting all this wealth and... And the Plishtim, the Philistines, are getting jealous of him. Who wouldn't, right? And all the wells that the workers of his father had dug out in the days of Abraham, they had plugged up. And they had filled with dust or dirt.
I think that directly relates to what she is saying, because I see the wells as salvation springing up into everlasting life, and the Philistines or enemies want to throw dirt in it, so the cares and concerns of this world, so we're distracted.
Could be, yeah. But before you go straight to the metaphor, think about the practical. If you're in this land and there's a bunch of new wells, why on earth would you stop them up? Why not just grab them and take them for yourself?
Well, they did that later.
Okay.
I can relate to the Palestinians, honestly.
Okay, wait. We're talking about Philistines, and I'm glad you brought that up, actually, because people have to be careful with terminology. Philistines, where did they come from? Who remembers?
The sea
people, Kafto.
Greece.
Right? They're like Grecian islands.
Yeah.
You can tell by their pottery. They have more in common with Grecian island pottery in their time than with local Canaanite pottery. So they're Grecian people. The name has morphed and been reapplied all over the place. Today, the people you see who are Palestinians are not connected to the Plishtim. They're different people groups completely. You can refer to this area, biblically, it's the land of the Philistines, even before there are Philistines, you could say, because the Philistines got here in, like, what was it, 1200 BC? And I don't know how you date your Abraham stories, but a lot of people date them a little earlier than that. Or you don't have to. It's up to you. But this area is still known as the land of the Philistines.
But nevertheless, you say, don't let's get into metaphors. When I was reading this morning, I've always equated the Philistines as the enemy of God's people, if you like, in Scripture.
Mm-hmm.
They come against David the whole time and so mm-hmm. on. And what the enemy does spiritually is all the things that are here. He blocks our springs of water. He blocks the well.
Okay.
He destroys. He's a quarreler. All the names that go on here.
It's interesting because in chapter 21, do you remember what happens? We had a treaty, right? Between who and who? Abraham and the king of Gerar, which is the same area, right? The king before him, who's also somehow named Avimelech. And that treaty, do you remember what the king said to Abraham?
No.
I want a treaty with you and my grandchildren, my great-grandchildren. It was supposed to go on for 3 generations. Okay, so now Abraham's died, and that king has died. So we have the second generation, Isaac and the new Avimelech. And whoop, where's the treaty?
Well, could this be just a renewing of a former treaty then?
Well, there needs to be a renewing because they're just breaking the treaty here. Like, you don't go plug up a well then. That's not operating within the treaty.
It's also an indication that treaties aren't in and of themselves evil.
No. In fact, I think it's showing... It's showing that Abraham and his family were very respectful. They were making treaties. They were doing everything properly. And here we have a disintegration of relationships because there's been a broken treaty. And they go and they fill up the wells. And
the word, I don't know what the word for a treaty is in Hebrew.
Brit.
It is a brit?
Well, covenant, okay, there's different ones.
I think it's a different word because what I was going to
there's
say
different
is
ones.
That a treaty gets broken, whoever makes treaties. They're sort of human things, and I'm not saying a treaty is evil, but I'm saying that it's potentially breakable, which is what happens, and then we have here now yet another treaty, and I don't remember what the final outcome of that is, except we've got the city of Beersheba. But a covenant, it's God who makes covenants, and by and large, he never breaks his covenants.
Yeah, but that's because he's God. The word brit, covenant
is a cutting.
You can have between people. We have it between people all over the Bible.
Right.
And you can have it between a person and God. The difference is that when it's coming from God,
God doesn't break
it's the real thing. Yeah.
Sometimes God blesses those treaties and he's sometimes he's not. Sometimes God blesses wars and sometimes he's not.
Right.
Okay, so if you remind yourself in Genesis 21, verse 22, at that time, Avimelech and Phichol, the commander of his army, said to Abram, God is with you in all that you do. Now swear to me. So here the word is hishav'ah, swear.
Swear.
Right? Swear to me right here in God's name, says Belohim, that you will not deceive me, my children, or my descendants. No. You won't lie to me, it says. Show me and the land where you are staying the same loyalty that I have shown you.
Abram swears.
Yeah, Abram says, I swear to do this. But Abram lodged a complaint against Avimelech concerning a well that Avimelech's servants had seized. I do not know who has done this thing, Avimelech replied. Moreover, you did not tell me. I did not hear about it until today. And so they have this treaty. They make a treaty. That's in verse 27. And that's a brit. And they have the seven lambs. And then you have this whole place name of Be'er Sheva. Because he swore an oath there. So they have two midrashim. They have one according to the seven lambs, and one, the official one, is swearing the oath. And in our chapter, we're going to get a third reason. We call it Be'er Sheva. Anyway, so they have this big treaty, right? However, here, they're stopping up the wells. And I was going to mention that one reason they may have stopped up the wells instead of taking them is because they see that this person is getting greater strength, is being bigger and bigger. And so at some point, if he's strong enough, he can take them back. So the idea is like, if I can't have them, you can't have them either. So I'm just going to stop them up, even though you think they would just be valuable water supply. What's another reason they may have stopped them up? If you have a well, it's a physical thing in the land, just like Abraham has a grave. So maybe it could be seen as like a foothold locally, like you own something. And so you want to kind of erase that fact, and so you stop up the well, lest he claims it as a physical possession.
It says they stopped them up after Abraham. The father servants in the days of Abraham's father, then the Philistines stopped, and that's in 15, and it says, which they had digged in the days of Abraham. So,
wow, it says digged in your Bible?
In
Isaiah, yes, dug in the time of Abraham's father. 15, as I've got dug.
Yeah, because they had a treaty with Abraham, right? So I guess regime change always, people try to stick their elbows out a bit. Mm-hmm. And maybe, like, who's going to follow up on enforcing this treaty? Now is our chance to stop it up, stop up the wells.
I got terribly spiritualized about it all, which is not really my thing, but I did.
Well, that's okay as a second layer, right?
All right. So I can get to that in a minute, can I?
Okay, make it now,
but
brief. Well,
I thought, with all these, this opening and closing, what are wells? They are the symbol of life and water and mm-hmm. spiritual life. With joy you will draw water from the wells of salvation, and so on. And I thought, how the enemy, we find a well of life. Mm-hmm. I don't know, we suddenly come to a new understanding of the Holy Spirit, or we suddenly come to a new understanding of water baptism, whatever you like. Mm-hmm. And Christians do it all the time. And we've got this well, and we're so excited about it. And then somebody comes along and they start to argue, no, that's not spiritually correct or theologically correct. What's the word I want? And so we actually dam up and we argue about everybody else's wells instead of rejoicing that there are all these upteen wells and we can end up now with seven wells.
Yeah,
I don't know, because you get to Isaiah 12, you come to the Lord himself, who is the spring of water, and those of us who are in him, we're supposed to have, out of our bellies are supposed to flow the rivers of water.
I think the key here is the whole jealousy factor. Jealousy leads to everything bad, you know? And these plishtim, you have different people groups who meet the people of Israel throughout the Bible, and you can watch their reactions. And you don't have to be jealous when someone's blessed. You can join in their blessing.
Yeah.
If you're like Jethro, you acknowledge
God's blessed you, let me be part of that. Or you can be jealous and try to take it away. And if you see you can't take it away, you try to ruin it for them. And those are like, if you want to do the metaphorical understanding, the person you want to line up with is the one who joins a blessing and not the one who is jealous of that blessing. So you have Isaac. He says, go away from us. Avimelech tells Isaac to go away from us. And I was reading some medieval commentaries that this could actually have been a protective measure for him. Because if people are too jealous and he's a foreigner, they may just try to get rid of him, take care of him, as the mafia would say, and acquire all his blessing. So he's saying, go away from us, because you're greater than us. And this is the same word, ki atzamta mimenu, it's the same concept and word that you get in the beginning of Exodus, when the people are thriving in Egypt, and they're getting more and more, and they're getting stronger, and the Pharaoh is worried, because if they get too strong, they're going to join enemies and attack them, in his mind.
I just wanted one extra, this word jealousy and envy. They're not the same. I have envy here, which in my view is the correct word, because jealousy is having feelings about what is actually yours. Envy is wanting something that belongs to somebody else. God is a jealous God. He wants about his land, his people, whatever it happens to be.
Okay.
But envy is wanting something that's not yours, and we use it wrongly.
The problem is we might use it wrongly in English, but the word we're dealing it with is vaikan'u, and they were, I would just say, jealous. Because Elkana, the jealous God, it's the same word. It's the same root. Nun Aleph is what we're talking about. So it's used of God, and it's used of these people here. And hey, it was their land. Eretz Plishtim. They were there. Right? So they are. It is being taken away from them.
Right.
But and I just think jealous.
In English, I think it's really important to look at the difference, because
okay.
People say, oh,
I'll try to be better.
No, not you. But I mean, the example I always think of is somebody says, oh, they've had this wonderful holiday and whatever. And people say, I'm so jealous you had a great. No, it was his holiday. He paid for it. He worked.
Have to say, I'm so envious.
I'm so envious.
I will try to remember that.
And that's the sin, because it's not yours, it's his.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
That's the word is covet.
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 Yes, yeah. Okay.
Is that Canaan's land?
Yeah.
That's the same as land of Canaan?
No. Canaan is this.
Okay.
Sorry, I'm mixing script and writing. So back to where we are on the map. So he has to leave Gerar, and he goes to, where does he go?
Oh, Rehoboth.
No, wait. First he sets up his tent in Nahal Grav. So he hasn't gone very far, right? He moves out of the city, down the Nahal some distance, and maybe a Nahal maybe opened up into a field, and I don't know where it is. My map's imprecise, so I won't even draw a dot. But he moves some distance, and he stays there, and he digs some wells. that were already dug in Abraham's day, and the Plishtim. Okay, so but it says he digs them. He has to dig them up again.
He reopened the wells that had been dug in the time of his father Abraham. Is that not correct?
Okay. Well, it says, and he dug wells that had been dug in the days of Abraham that were blocked up.
Yeah.
So yeah, practically the same thing. And he calls them names, like the names that Abraham had called them. And so they found there, where they were digging, they found a well of living water. So that's interesting that they must have tapped into a very good fountain system or something. The fact that it mentions they found there is kind of like a surprise finding. It's not just, we know that they're good at digging wells because they've done it already, but this is something exceptional. You know, you got all this water, and now everybody's really fighting over it, because this is like a gold mine, right? Water's gold in the desert. And so then you have all the shepherds of both sides fighting over it. One saying it's our water. And so what do they call it?
Essek.
Essek. Because they contended over it. Hit asku. They
disputed.
Today they got in each other's business.
It says after the names by which his father had called them, so maybe they were disputing back then too.
Yeah, that's interesting. But I think this is a new well. Like, he started undoing all the other wells, and now they found this well. It's kind of like a new source of water. Maim Hayim, living water, is just running water. So this isn't my field of expertise. Like, what would be the difference between just digging a well and finding water? It's more spring, probably something that's gushing more maybe on the surface.
I got really excited about this last week when I thought we were going to do it.
Like Joseph.
Like Joseph?
Joseph well in Nablus.
Like Joseph's well in Nablus.
That a well we have to dig to reach our wells of living water? It doesn't come naturally. I mean, it's what you do all the time. You're digging wells and you're showing us the living water. That's what you're doing. But a spring comes out from nowhere.
Yeah.
You suddenly come across it, you find it or something.
And in this case, as they're digging wells, they find the spring.
So maybe the two go together. We get into the word and we start digging for the truth, we suddenly get a revelation or something.
Yeah.
And think, oh, praise the Lord, you know, this is really what it means.
Right. Yeah. So he keeps naming these wells, and he digs another well, and they, you know, they argue about that one, and so they name it
Sitna.
You see our nice word there. What is a Satan? What adversary? Right. So he gets out of there, and he digs another well, and this time finally they don't argue over it.
Wait a minute, where have you got Satan? I've got Sitna.
Sitna. I'm referring to the base word there.
Sitna is a base word of Satan?
Yeah, Satan. Which script do you like? Sin, Tet, Nun. Right? That's your word. We make it a name in English. Satan.
Yeah.
Or the adversary, some translations have. When Jesus says, get behind me, Satan.
So one's a sin and one's a sheen.
No, this is the same. I don't know which script you like. Do you like
person
or choose whichever one you like?
My handwriting will be bad in either one.
Thank you.
So you've had two places. He's gone to one place, dug a well, they argued. He went to the next place, dug a well, they argued.
And so, like, the third time, finally, they're not arguing. And so he names it?
Rechovot. Rachav, it's a wide open space, right? And so he sees this as an answer to prayer that God has finally opened up land for them and that no one's arguing about it.
And now it's the worst traffic jams in town.
Well, I don't know if it's the same.
The Rehovot we're talking about is down here.
I'm talking about the neighborhood of Rehovot, which is the worst traffic jam in town,
right,
instead
right.
of this wide open space, which they obviously thought it was in the beginning.
Now, there was a nice little note. Where was it? I'm on the wrong page, that would help. Okay, so there's some discussion in this verse. He names it Rechovot, and he says, because now God has made an open space for us. Ufarinu va'aretz. And the question is, what that means. What is the relationship between the two halves of the verse? God's made an open expanse, and now we're going to multiply.
Yeah, but then we hear he's settling down. He's now settled down for a second time. He's now got given this amazing open space, and he's settling down. and we're going to flourish in the land I have. And then the next verse, he goes on to Beersheba, which is a schlep. It's not very far, I guess, but it's still a schlep. And
so he's leaving that place.
He's leaving the place where he settled once. He's now settling twice.
Yeah.
And now he ends up in Beersheba. So he's still more of a...
And it seems like he's already has flourished, but now having an uncontested well, I guess, is some type of milestone that can allow them to multiply even more. Why he leaves there then to Beersheba, I don't know. Maybe he viewed it as a kind of a gvul, right?
Yeah.
Like, we have our well here, this marks us, it's uncontested. Now I can go back to Beersheba.
Well, you talked about how they have to move around so much to get in the grass. So they don't necessarily stay there for long anyway, I don't think.
We talked about that before. This is the first time we've got an account of him settling down and...
Yeah, but his people work for him. They probably bring the flocks out and, you know, leave the guys out with the sheep out in the...
So it sort of has to sprout. The first year while he's waiting for everything to start growing from the water, he goes back to Beersheba, lives in the city.
Yeah, maybe, or it's what you're saying is it could be part of a rotation, and you go back to Beersheba.
Or his base, he's the head guy. He's in Beersheba.
Yeah. And maybe the famine's being lifted. I mean, we know from previous chapters that Beersheba is kind of where Isaac, that area is where he likes to live. So maybe he's going back home in that sense.
So it's the mixture of the nomad and the
cultivator
mm-hmm. sort of mixed together.
Right.
And like Terence says, it's very possible that he can go back and stay there, whereas somebody's staying back to look after his crops or moving the animals on or whatever.
And we also have, he may have built, did it mention?
He builds an
already
altar.
Altars before. But here he goes back to Beersheba. Abraham had built an altar.
Right.
So it could be something to do with that. It's certainly a bigger place than the places he's been. Like if you're sick of pioneering out here, you might go back to something more established. But it's here that God appears to him again and gives another confirmation of the promise. Don't worry, I'm with you, and I will bless you, and I will multiply your seed. Because of Abraham, my servant.
And it's interesting that Abraham, dad, goes on being of enormous importance all the way through because it's Abraham's wells and it's the promise to Abraham.
Sure.
Abraham is not lost.
No. Except when it comes to his treaty.
Abraham and Abraham, yeah.
Now, what's curious then, let me see what they say about it here. Okay, so then he pitches his tent, and he digs another well, but it says, Vayichru sham, avdei Yitzhak be'er.
Where are you, 25?
I am, what verse is that? 25, yeah. So the question is, why did they say Vayichru instead of Vayachperu?
I haven't got it in Hebrew. What are you saying?
They dug another well, but it uses a different word for dig.
Oh.
And it could be poetic. We have in Numbers 21:18, the Sarim, the princes have dug a well, and the noblemen have dug her.
Can you write the two words up in Hebrew for us?
Yeah.
Is it like in modern Hebrew where it's more significant digging, like to
excavate?
Yeah, well, I mean in modern Hebrew that's like where you
quarry more.
Yeah.
Maybe, but I'm thinking about like Beersheba. I guess if you dig in the rock, maybe they're digging in the rock.
Right.
Well, they do have those, you know, in Beersheba, all those waterworks underneath, they're dug out of rock, right? The water reservoirs.
And which is
so
the word that's being used up until now?
This is the one, Nachpo, the one on the left.
Yeah, this Nachpo is you dig it in dirt.
Right.
This you can dig rock and dirt.
But they're using another one for quarry there, right?
Chatzav, yeah, also. But if you look at Numbers 21:18,
you'll find them in parallel.
And isn't that parallel, like you said, poetic?
It can be poetic, yeah. Yeah.
I still want to get to know the difference. Kafur is the normal word that's used, right? Or not?
It's just a normal word for dig. You could say it's a basic word for dig, yeah.
Right.
It's just interesting. I'm not making anything out of it, but I don't know, maybe. Maybe they've decided to make a water reservoir in rock. I don't know. And that's when Avimelech goes to him in Gerar.
From Gerar.
Ah, yeah, from Gerar to his place. And he says, why have you come to me? Because you hate me, right? You sent me away. And they say, we've seen that God's with you. And so basically they need a covenant because now he's a serious player. And so they have a covenant. They cut a brit. And so he promises not to do anything bad to them.
That's a very good example of what you said a few minutes ago, which is before they're jealous and everything goes amok, now suddenly they see the Lord is with them and they've got the blessing, and so let's join them. So
yeah.
When we see something good, instead of being envious or whatever it is.
And they remind you, we didn't do anything bad to you, we didn't touch you, like we didn't kill you, we did only good to you. And we sent you off in peace.
You're blessed by the Lord.
It's true. All those things are true. They sent him off in peace. They said, get out of here peacefully. But again, back to that interpretation that sending them off could have been protecting them because the people were so jealous of everything they had. So in that sense, it was sending them off in peace. Better to go in peace than to die where you are. And they have a mishteh. That's wonderful. They have a feast. And they get up to go. And before they go, they have an oath, and that's why we call it Be'er Sheva. All right, so there's our third understanding of the word Be'er Sheva. And that's where our little parasha ends. So quickly, we've got about 5 minutes to connect it up to Isaiah. And I think the biggest links you'll see in the very beginning. We've already linked it to our Gospels stories and this divine, miraculous production of wheat. And now we're going to go to Isaiah 62:8 and following to 63:7. And we have Nishba Adonai Bimino Uvizroa Ozo. So we have this swearing an oath, it's starting with, but this time it's God swearing the oath, thankfully, because he keeps his promises. And what is this oath? He's not going to let your, what? Your grain be your enemy's food. And no foreigner is going to drink your grapes, your new wine that you labored for. So, how does that connect to our place?
Well, the envy of the Philistines and presumably drinking their wine,
mm-hmm.
the new wine which they had created, they got so well. And the Lord is saying, now you're going to harvest your own, you're going to eat
right.
your own.
Yeah, it is interesting. If he has this miraculous harvest, Mea Shearim, and then he gets kicked out of the place, you have that harvest, but you're not going to have another harvest. You know, you've been cut out of your land, really. You have to start over somewhere else.
And somebody else will go on, presumably, taking the advantage after all.
But in this country, what's always a problem at the time of the judges? Why is Gideon in the gut threshing his grain? Why is he in the gut?
Because they're stealing it, right?
Midianim are stealing it.
Yeah.
Other people, the foreigners are stronger, they come in and they steal the grain. And so this happens repeatedly.
They don't even need the land. They just come in after you've done the work.
After you've done all the work and they take it.
So they don't have to possess the land or pay for the land.
Of course, these were some of the consequences if you read through Leviticus, and they say, if you don't follow what I'm telling you today, you're going to work hard and other people are going to get it. They're called the futility oaths.
Well, and this is what, like, so jumping to when this reading was happening, this is what the Romans would do. They
sure.
They would come through and, just, you know, like soldiers would come and, like, pillage, yeah. or not even just pillage, but just show up in town and say, feed me and all my men. You
yeah,
know?
Like David.
They expected to just feed them. There was, like, food, you know.
Yeah. Okay. So God is showing a time that this is all going to be reversed. So instead of always being the underdog where everything you do just gets taken by other people, you're going to eat your own grain. And so it kind of seems like you could see a link between the two, because here we have a miraculous supply of grain in the middle of enemy territory. And here we have, even in your own territory, that you're going to actually get that grain. The miracle is that you retain it instead of the enemy taking it away from you. And then there's also mention of making this road, flattening it, making a straight path for people to come back. And again, the end of Isaiah, we're talking about people coming back from exile. And they have to get rid of all the stones so people don't trip. And raise a standard to the nations.
But it's also a prophetic passage, isn't it?
Yes.
I mean, because the verse before, I posted, watch on your walls, Jerusalem. We're back at Jerusalem, Gary.
Yeah, we're back at Jerusalem. Good. Another point we've been bringing up in each of these connecting prophetic selections, the emphasis has always been Jerusalem, which is very fascinating.
And building up a highway like that, it implies peace with your neighbors.
Yeah, yeah.
You don't need a highway unless...
Because the nations are the one telling Bat Zion, look, your salvation's coming. And his reward is with him. Which that reminds us of Abraham's promise, right? Your reward is great, after it says that he had been faithful in chapter 15. And his wages, or however you want to say, pe'ulato, he brings a reward and wages with him.
But I think the Haftarah goes on into 63:7, which is no accident.
Yes.
Because it's the real, almost like the anger of God. Who is coming down? I mean, this is a mighty victory which he's going to do, but it's not a simple business.
Right? Why are you coming out of Edom? And again, Edom and Judah were rivals throughout history, and they go back to Edom goes back to Esav.
Esau,
exactly. And so, how this whole section on Edom and stomping grapes. Pouring out their lifeblood. I don't know. But it could be that vengeance, yeah.
And I think if you bring it into modern times, I think we can become very sentimental with this God of love without realizing that he's really angry with the nations that will turn against Jerusalem in this case. Never be silent, you call on the Lord, give yourselves no rest, and he gives him no rest, he establishes Jerusalem. And makes her a praise in all the earth.
Right.
And you see this sort of...
But it ends, I will tell about all the Lord did for us, the many good things he did for the family of Israel. That he, it uses, keeps using the word gamal, that he gave them this result. He rewarded them, in a sense.
Where is gamal?
It's several times in verse 7. But it's not because of what they did, simply because of his compassion and great faithfulness. So you have that beautiful contrast. Usually, gmul yadayim is you know, the recompense, the result of what you've worked for. And in this case, the result of what you work for is really miraculous. It's given to you by God because he wants to. It's not really what you worked for anyway. And that's why Isaac found this spring in the desert. And that's why he got Mea She'arim.
Serendipity or not?
Serendipity, divine providence.
And Gamal? Gamal is the word in Hebrew?
Yeah.
For what?
To reward, to seek the consequence, to get the consequences. It's also, well, a different sense.
It's camel, isn't it, a gamal?
Well, yeah, I don't know if that's the same root, though, but it certainly sounds the same, right? You also have a word, li gamel is to be weaned.
And the camel holds all this water, you know.
Yeah, well, don't go there yet. You can write poetry that way, but don't try to make real connections. There's a lot of words that their roots look identical, but they were originally separate roots. So you always have to kind of watch out for that. So if you're going to do word studies, you know, they'll call it gamal 1 and gamal 2 kind of thing.
You know, false cognate?
False cognate, well, that's when you're jumping that's between languages. But it's the same idea. Yeah. Homophone, or what do you call it?
Homonym.
It sounds the same,
but not
the same. Same letters in this case, but not the same.
It's like read in English.
But even more so, if they were spelled identically, but they're from different roots. Okay, so with that, we'll go downstairs to worship service. Be encouraged that after all your efforts, your blessing will come from God. Not because of your efforts, although he does honor the efforts. They are divine. And if we keep our heart from jealousy, I think that's the main attitude we should have. And seeking peace with our neighbors, I think we saw that in this selection as well, really strongly. No matter what they were doing, right? So, Shabbat Shalom. Okay, raga.